Geraldine Jameson on Manx Radio.
Hello and a warm welcome to my regular summer interlude, which gives a second opportunity to listen to a selection of my favourite programme guests. Now, this week's choice is the legendary motor racing commentator Murray Walker, who in 2000 announced his forthcoming retirement at the end of that Grand Prix season. So here once again is really a great friend of the Isle of Man, Murray Walker.
That sounds marvellous from you anyway. Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
It's super to have you actually on our premises, because you're no stranger, of course, I know, to the island. And we were having a little chat before starting the programme, Murray, and you told me an amazing fact, that all this broadcasting of yours has been a mere hobby. You've had another job all this time.
Yeah, I was in the advertising business for over 30 years, I suppose. I started in 1946 when I came out of the army, and I retired from it 2 years ago. But as you rightly say, the broadcasting was a hobby. It was something I liked doing, and if you like doing things enough, you find the time to do them. And it's worked very well, I think, one way and another.
I suppose in the early days you would have thought, well, I can do this at the weekends, you know, and the job during the week.
Well, in the early days you could do it in the weekends, but the advertising job was almost entirely Monday to Friday, and the broadcasting was almost entirely weekends. And my wife used to look after the management bits, you know, booking the hotels and arranging the cars to go to places and all that sort of thing. And I would leave the office. I had an office in St. James's Square, next door but one to the Libyan embassy. And it was our office, actually, that they used as the headquarters when they had the siege at the Libyan embassy. And I would leave there on Friday and go off to wherever I had to go off. And then on Sunday evening I would come back. And I actually wrote a book 1 year doing that. While Elizabeth was driving the car back from whatever we'd been doing, I sat in the passenger seat writing the book.
Well, it must be nostalgic for you, coming back to our island. What are your first memories coming here as a small boy with your very famous father, of course, Graham?
Yes, well, my father, as you rightly say, used to race here, and I think he first came here about 1921, and I must have come here around about 1928, I should think. And we stayed in the Castle Mona. I was a little boy. I was the only child in the place. And this was at a time when all the top riders stayed at the Isle of Man, at the Castle Mona, I'm sorry. And they would come down in their leathers to breakfast in the morning, and there would be Uncle Jimmy Guthrie at one table, and Uncle Jimmy Simpson at another table, and Uncle Stanley Woods at another table. And it was absolutely magic for me, because I was able to go everywhere and do everything. And I don't think I realised then how lucky I was.
This was the mecca of the motorcycling road racing calendar.
Well, you're touching a very raw spot now, because the TT in the Isle of Man is, to me, the greatest sporting event of any kind in the world. And in its heyday, it was absolutely fantastic. It is a matter of tragic regret to me that it lost the World Championship, since when, regrettably, it is not the event it used to be. The top riders don't really come here anymore, notwithstanding the efforts of the island, and hats off to the island for everything it's done. It's done everything it possibly could. But regrettably, like the Mia Amelia in Italy, like the Nürburgring in Germany, I'm afraid the course is just too tough and demanding for today's competitors, is the brutal truth of the matter.
Well, is that what...
Or am I being too serious now?
Oh, no. You're touching a subject which I was going to bring up. I'm delighted that you're doing so, Murray, because it will be of terrific interest, I think, to the current TT generation. I mean, you say that, OK, I agree with you, that it lost the world status, the world championship status, but I understand that the factories found it really too expensive to send over really top machines to go round rattling to pieces round a road circuit for 2 weeks.
Well, jolly good. You've done your homework, haven't you?
Listen, when I'm in the company of such a professional. But when they really could have had a lot less risk and outlay,
yes,
on a short, flat circuit for a week.
Well, I was going to say all that, but I don't know. But, I mean, that is the truth of the matter. The TT course, 37 and three-quarter miles, seven laps in those days, is jolly demanding. There is one thing that you didn't mention, which I'd better get in, and that is that it's a tremendously difficult circuit to learn. And the Continentals resented having to come over here and do an apprenticeship for perhaps two or three years before they knew the course. And then on top of that, they had to spend a fortnight here for practice and the race. As you rightly say, with today's two-stroke machinery, which wears out very quickly, it was terribly expensive. So they were wearing out the machinery. They were, in their view, wasting their time when they could be taking part in two continental meetings in that time and make more money. Well, the money thing's been put right now with a vengeance, because I think you can make more money if you win the TT now than any other two or three events put together. But it was the World Championship loss that sounded, not his death knell, because it's a great, great event, and people still come over in their thousands to watch it. But regrettably, it hasn't got the charisma that it used to have.
Yes, but do you think these factories and the World Championship, the loss of that, were really excuses, were the real causes, and not the excuse that they put up at the time, grounds of safety?
Well, it's a very complicated situation, isn't it? I mean, you had one or two riders, who had better be nameless or so be suing me, who rubbished the Isle of Man and the TT course on safety grounds, and I think it was just because they didn't want to race here. It's not that the factories can't make the machines, because of course they can. They can make whatever machinery is needed to tackle whatever event it is. But it's a complex of money, time, safety, and many other things. I remember when my father first raced here. I don't remember it, but I remember him telling me about it. When you went up the mountain, there were no roads. There was a kart track. And when you got to the bottom of the mountain on your single-track motorbike, you literally had to decide which of the kart tracks you were going to ride in, the one on the left or the one on the right, that the kart wheels had made furrows, and you went like that. And when you got to Keppel Gate, you actually had to ride through a gateway where a wooden gate had been opened. And I've got a photograph at home of my father standing proudly beside a wooden gatepost. And it's all festooned with ribbons and cabbages and things. And this was because he had made such a fuss about Keppel Gate that some enthusiasts or some of his mates had actually got up during the night and dug up the gatepost at Keppel Gate and brought it home to him.
Of course, this was the greatest free show on earth. I mean, the people could watch it from the course without having to pay.
Oh, well, still is, presumably. I mean, on the Thursday night, the tradition was that the boats would come over from Liverpool in dozens almost, loaded with enthusiasts, who would then walk up the course. And the farthest they could normally get on their feet and still get back to the boat in time was Cregner Bar. And that was why Cregner Bar was absolutely thick with people. It's still got to be the greatest free show in the world now.
Were you there when your father, he won the TT, didn't
yes,
he? The lightweight in 34.
Yes, I was I was there, and I think insufferable. He won, and I was very, very proud about it. And he rode the bike back from the paddock to the Castle Mona Hotel, which, as I said, was where everybody stayed in those days. He when you go into the castle, I haven't been there recently, but there used to be these pillars on the right and left as you went in the main door at the Castle Mona.
They're still there.
With a sort of buttress thing at the bottom of them. And he put the bike against the buttress. And very full of myself and what he had done, I got on his bike and I suppose I was about 7 years old at the time, and I was doing the young poser bit, and my mother was watching me, and I turned to my mother and I said, Mummy, do you think they know who I am?
You were probably clairvoyant, because if they didn't know then, by golly, they certainly do now.
I think I got my knuckles wrapped and sent upstairs.
Talk about a memorable voice, even developing at an early age. Yeah. Well, you say that the Isle of Man has done everything they can to try and preserve the TT races in some shadow of its former glory. Should we have turned to car racing? Would that have helped the situation?
I mean, the Isle of Man's tried car racing, hasn't it? It had the Manin Beg and the Manin Moor before the war. In 1949, one of the first broadcasts I ever did was the car race which went down the Glen Crutchery Road past the grandstands. I remember Stirling Moss was driving in an 1100 Cooper Japp. I just don't know. I think you're going to have the same problem here that happens with the motorcycle racing, and that is that people have got to do two sea journeys to get here. I'm sorry, I just don't know the answer to that. My suspicion is that car racing would not succeed here, because in order for it to succeed, you've got to generate an enormous crowd. And how are they going to get 100,000 people to the Isle of Man to watch a car race?
Mm. Yes, it seems really a catch-22 situation.
Your programme is going out after I've left the island. Is it?
We have ways and means. Now, you, of course, were the BBC TT race commentator for several years. And one of your tricks was to always get down into the pits, you know, when there was a lap or a lull in your commentary. And you were always working hard, chatting to the competitors, enhancing your commentary.
Still do, I hope. I mean, not here, unfortunately, but everywhere else, because if you are commentating, you are supposed to know what you're talking about. And the only way you can know what you're talking about is to talk to people. And my modus operandi always is, always has been, and always will be, when I'm not actually on the air, to spend all my time talking to team owners, team managers, riders, drivers, mechanics, everyone you can think of. And yes, I used to do that then. And I think I've actually been in more commentary positions in the Isle of Man than anyone else, because I started off...
I was going to say, can you remember your first TT commentary?
Oh, yes, because I was nearly killed. It was in 1949, and I was at Ballacrane, where the George Formby pub, you know, where they turn right and off towards Ramsey. And they didn't have a commentary box, and I was standing in the middle of the road, tethered with electronic equipment, wires, headphones, microphones, clipboards, stopwatches, all that sort of thing. And Les Graham comes hurtling down the road towards me on his HAS. This was the 350 race. And I thought he's leaving it all a bit late. And he was leaving it a bit late because his brakes had failed, and he came straight at me, and I realised it at the very last moment and leapt to one side while he stopped and went on round the course and didn't do very well in that race. But I was at Craignabar, I was at the Highlander, where I stood by a telegraph, you know, the pub at the Highlander, and directly opposite that there's a telegraph pole. That's where the commentary position was, and they used to come straight through the air at you and landed at about 130 miles an hour, literally about 6 feet in front of me, and then they had to peel off a bit to go around the Greba Bends. And that was an exciting place to be. Then I was at Kirkmichael. Then I was at Ramsey. And the commentary position at Ramsey used to be a sort of mobile road mender's hut, which was in the courtyard of the pub just before they turn right and then go on up the mountain. Then I was at Craignabar. And then, sadly, when my father died and was no longer doing the number one commentator, I finished my days in the grandstand itself. And it was when I was at Craignabar one year for the Clips course, and my father was at the grandstand, and this was in 1954 for the lightweight TT, when it was a foregone conclusion that a German NSU rider was going to win. And there was a world champion, a chap called Werner Haas, H-A-A-S. And you always long to say something and get away with it. And I achieved this because my old man was doing the commentary. It was a mass start. So he said, well, away they go. There's 26 competitors. They've rushed away down the Glen Crutchery Road, down towards the top of Bray Hill. They turn right and they come to within sight of Craignabar and our commentator, Murray Walker. And I said, yes, and here they come, Haas first. I seem to have an incredible knack of opening my mouth and putting my foot in it.
Well, much as we would like, of course, to stay on what is obviously a great favourite of yours, our TT course, there are other Grand Prix that have figured largely in your life. I mean, let's take the Ulster Grand Prix, Monaco. I mean, Did the TT, for instance, set you on your world commentary course?
Well, not really, Geraldine, because, funnily enough, the first broadcast I ever had anything to do with was not bikes at all, it was cars. I started my broadcasting career because I wanted to commentate. Now, whether I wanted to commentate because my father did it or whether I wanted to commentate because I wanted to commentate, I don't know. I've often tried to look into my own motivation and work out why it all happened, and I've never succeeded. But the fact remains that I wanted to do it.
It's in you, really, isn't it? I think you have to be born with a talent and a desire.
Well, let's put it this way. In order to commentate successfully, if I commentate successfully, you've certainly got to have three attributes. First of all, you've got to be enthusiastic. Secondly, you've got to be knowledgeable. And thirdly, you've got to be able to put words together. And unless you've got all three of those elements, you can't do the job. Because I've come across plenty of people that know a hell of a lot about it, but can't talk about it. And I'm sure, as you have, I've met lots of people who can talk, but who don't know what they're talking about, you see.
So, it does make life difficult. Yes. But it's not the case at the moment.
And really, you've got to, if you are commentating as a specialist chap on a specific subject, you've got to know the subject and then be able to talk about it so that you can extract the knowledge from your nut and turn it into hopefully entertaining words and phrases for people who are watching or listening.
Mm. Have you actually got a favourite Grand Prix venue?
Yes. The one I like going to most, I think, is Austria, because I like Austria. It is held in an absolutely fabulous location, the Österreich Ring, which is down towards Salzburg near Austria, in the pointy bit of Austria near Italy and Yugoslavia. The countryside is marvellous. We happen to stay in a fabulous hotel. The food is superb. And in this particular place where we stay, there's always the main teams like Williams and Ferrari and Brabham and Tolman and so on. So you are there even more than at most places, part of the scene. It's like staying in the Castlemaner during TT week, if you follow me. You're part of the scene, and there's Nelson Piquet at the next table, and Keke Rosberg comes in, and you're...
It's a specialised, glamorous atmosphere.
Yes. Oh, yes. And of course, Monaco. You've got to be some sort of a nut if you don't like Monaco, because the atmosphere you could cut with a cricket stump there. It's quite amazing. It's where the jet set meet the ordinary people. It's where the sun is shining. You've got this fabulous location with the yachts. You've got all the noise and excitement. And although the cars aren't, in fact, going all that quickly in comparison with other circuits, my God, they're going damn quickly in comparison with anything else. Brands Hatch, actually. People sometimes are a bit surprised when I say Brands Hatch, but it's a wonderful circuit, and it's the one the drivers like the most. So I think those are my three favourites, but I like them all, actually.
When the season starts, have you got in your mind a favourite driver that you would like to see go all the way through? Perhaps somebody not quite at the top, but knocking at the door. Do you find that you're rooting for them?
No, I think for all sorts of reasons, one of which is, and I must be a little pompous now, I am supposed to be professionally neutral. Another is that I actually like all of them. I like some of them more than the others. There are one or two who are pretty intolerable personalities, and no, of course I'm not going to tell you who they are. But most of them are extremely nice. So, no, I don't think I have any particular favourites.
You were greatly associated for many years with Grandstand and Sports Night. Now, what was the pressure of live television like, Murray?
Well, you use the past tense. What is the pressure of live television like? Because all the Grand Prix that we do now are live. And although in Britain, unfortunately, you don't see the whole of every Grand Prix, our coverage and our commentary goes live in its entirety to Australia, to Canada, to South Africa, to New Zealand, and the parts of North America that Canadian television reaches. So we have an absolutely gigantic audience.
But we're not always receiving it from those parts as it goes out. I mean, you have this time difference for a start.
Well, you except for things like the North American ones and the next Grand Prix of 1986, the first one, which is Rio, Brazil, they are live nowadays. Yes, there's the evening show as well, the Grand Prix program, the one with the famous music. But now Sunday Grandstand carries almost the whole of every Grand Prix. To get back to your question, the pressure is considerable because although you pick up the microphone not knowing whether no one is listening to you or 100 million people are listening to you worldwide, you're conscious of the fact that a hell of a lot of people are likely to be listening to you, and they regard you, rightly so, as the fount of all knowledge of what they are interested in, and you're conscious of the fact that you've got to endeavour to get it right, and you've got to get it right while it's actually happening. Am I rambling on too much on this?
No, not at all.
Well, if I may just say this, there is a considerable difference between commentating on an electronic medium like radio and television and being a press man. The difference being that if you're a press man, you sit there and you watch the race. When the race is finished, you write your report. Then you read your report. Then you phone your report through and somebody transposes it at the other end, as a result of which there ought to be plenty of opportunities for any mistakes which may have been made to be corrected. I, on the other hand, have literally seen the wrong words going down the wire, and what can you do? It's an instantaneous medium. They will have been following Lauda in the red and white Marlborough McLaren for a long time. Then all of a sudden, the producer will move to Prost, who is in an identical car visually. And I'm thinking about Lauda, I see the red and white car, and I say, so there goes Lauda into such and such a corner. I realise it wasn't Lauda at all, it was Prost. And everybody who's watching says, it really is time they started employing somebody who knew what he was talking about. He can't even tell the difference between Lauda and Prost. Now, I knew it wasn't Lauda, it was Prost, because I've caught up now. Now, there is no point in saying, just a minute, folks, it wasn't Lauda, it was Prost. And I did actually realise it was Prost, but by the time I'd realised it, because another lap's gone, you see.
You simultaneously commentated twice, I understand, for the BBC and ITV.
Yes, I claim to be the only person in captivity that you, at one point, you couldn't get away from, no matter where you went, because I was doing motocross, or scrambling as it was then called, on independent television live, and a recorded programme was going out on the BBC. Yes,
amazing. I mean, I think that is that is some achievement. We've talked about a lot of mostly your car racing, your motorcycle commentating, but I understand that you have diversified into both weightlifting and military tattoo.
Oh, God, you have done your research.
I always like to surprise my guests if I can.
there was a time in my early career when the great Peter Dimmock decided that he was going to make me a general commentator. And the first thing I had a go at was the White City tattoo, where I learnt the name of the regimental goat and the sergeant major and all the people in the United States Air Force band and all that sort of thing, which wasn't a great success. And then they gave me the Serpentine Regatta to do. If you can imagine anybody less attitudinally suited to doing rowing than me, I can't. But anyway, I made some derogatory remark about a lot of overgrown schoolboys standing around in pink caps and ties, only to discover that they were the senior members of Leander, which is the creme de la creme of the rowing world. So that was the end of my rowing career. And then I'm sitting in the in my office, my advertising agency office, one day, and the great Paul Fox phones me. And he was God, and in charge of sport. And this was, I vividly remember, a Thursday. And he said, "Hello, Paul. Hello, Murray. This is Paul." I said, "Hello, Paul. Are you doing anything on Saturday?" says Paul. well, it was my wedding anniversary and I was taking my wife out to dinner and all that sort of thing. But I said, no, Paul, I'm not doing anything. Can you do a job for me? He said, yes. He said, I want you to go to Bristol and do television commentary on the Great Britain versus the Commonwealth weightlifting championships. And he said, and don't tell me you don't know anything about it, because nor does anyone else, and you've got until Saturday to find out. And I did, and that one didn't go too badly.
Up to date with Manx Radio's dedicated motorsport website, motorsport.manxradio.com, your one-stop shop for news, travel, road closures and racing schedules. You can also step into Manx Radio 1368's 60-year motorsport archive, including interviews with your favourite riders, race highlights from yesteryear and our collection of motorsport videos and podcasts. motorsport.manxradio.com, the home for motorsport on the Isle of Man, from the best biking station in the world. Manx Radio 1368.